This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Michael Monks. Cincinnati lost two iconic men this weekend, former Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune and retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones. Portune, one of the longest-serving Democrats in the city's history, died of cancer Saturday. He was 61. He served in public office for 30 years on the city council and the county commission. Judge Nathaniel Jones, a relentless civil rights advocate, worked for 10 years as the NAACP's general counsel and served 23 years on the federal appeals court bench in Cincinnati. He died yesterday morning at the age of 93 from congestive heart failure. We will remember both men this hour. First, joining me to talk about Todd Portune are Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper, WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. We'd like to hear your thoughts and your stories as well. You can call us 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to start out talking about how each of you connected with Todd Portune, the first meetings perhaps that you had with him. And David, we'll start with you.
Sure. So obviously he and I ended up serving a term together when I was on the county commission. But as I explained it a few moments lately when I've talked about him, I actually got to know Todd Portune before I ever met him because I was a council candidate knocking on doors. And I knew of him. Obviously, he had just won, but I didn't know many politicians. But I got to know of his work very quickly because more than any other person by far, I'd knock on doors and we'd talk about whatever the big issues were. And then they'd say, you know that stop sign down there? Todd Portune got that put in there. Or, you know that red light or the traffic bump or whatever? Todd Portune did that. We called his office and he got it done. And after a few months, I was like, my gosh, this guy Todd Portune, you know, he's won the county commission race, stadiums, all that. But his name came up more than almost any, actually more than anyone else combined, as a guy whose office was always doing the most basic constituent service that oftentimes gets overlooked. So I got to know him short. I'm sure at some point in that first council race, I went to him and I met with him to you know, get his support and get to know him. And I don't remember that meeting. But I do remember saying to him, everywhere I go, you did something for somebody. And it always, ever since, taught me about, you know, and he did a lot of work on MSD stuff. Same thing. My guess is that's one reason he knew about the problems of the MSD.
We should say Metropolitan Sewer District.
I'm sorry, Metropolitan Sewer District. But from the very beginning, it kind of showed me, hey, here's someone who's got big vision, and we'll talk about that over the course of the next half hour, but he also was always handling the day-to-day stuff that people cared about so much so that a new guy running for office couldn't help but go a few blocks and hear about it. So it really, you know, that's how I first got to know him, was through that. And then we obviously had a long time working together. But it was really a sort of striking way to hear about his service was door to door. People just would bring him up for having made some difference in their lives.
Jay?
I started at WNKU. And now I have to be careful that I don't say that on the air now, in 1995. And we had – the radio station had another reporter that covered – city council full-time, but I'd be asked to fill in. So I covered Cincinnati City Council, and of course, at that time, Todd Portune was a member of city council and probably got my most interaction with him was when they were negotiating the different stadium deals at that time with the Bengals for the 1998 stadium agreement.
Howard?
Well, I guess I covered his first race for city council. I was there for that, and I remember this just energetic person who was just everywhere. I mean, he literally would work night and day. Every vote counted to this guy. And it's like David said, once he became a council member, he was that kind of a constituent service type. He had really always had really good people on his staff.
He did.
Always had somebody really good running his office. And they kept him informed. He concentrated on the big picture ideas, and he had a staff that was very well connected in the community, knew all the neighborhood council people, and could get things done. And it was just a perfect combination for city council.
Let's talk. When he first got elected to the Hamilton County Commission, he was the lone Democrat, the first Democrat in
decades that had been elected to the county commission and was in the minority, David, until you got elected as well. What was that time like for him, Howard J. David? What do you think it was? I mean, I remember covered the commission at that time, and people would say he can talk a lot, but nothing's going to change because the other two people there will vote him down every time. But he never stopped.
No, he never did stop. You know, but he saw that as part of his function. I mean, his function was to be the different voice. You know, the voice that might have been saying, you know, wait a minute, let's think about this. You know, we've been down this road before. Is this really a good idea? And when the Republican – and it drove Republicans crazy because, number one, they have to sit there and listen for a very long time. And but he was relentless at that. And he was a good opposition type to have in a minority.
And I think Commissioner Driehaus said this in a remembrance over the weekend. You know, even though he was in the minority, and the same thing when he went back, he was in the majority and then went back to the minority. He had all these things that, you know, he talked about and planted. And she talked about that when she got elected in 2016, took office in 2017, they had a long to-do list because all that stuff was filed back there that, well, I couldn't do this last year, the year before last. But I can now because I've got someone who will work with me.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. I recognize that to-do list. he had when I started running, we would talk, and he had built up all these things that he had perceived as needing to get done that he just couldn't get done. But I also will say, you know, it was a little less partisan then. I don't want to act like everything was nirvana or something. But especially, you know, when it was Dallin, who was a guy.
John Dallin.
Right. He was sort of your quintessential Ohio County Commission trying to have the county run well. You know, Todd would have gotten a lot done then. And back then, it took someone who could work with both sides. By the way, I talked about this the other day with someone else. He would win elections in a way that, as a Republican, you better pay attention to this guy.
Yes.
He wasn't squeaking by 51-49. He's running up big numbers in Republican parts of the county. I think partly because of that constituent service helping these local communities. So I think people knew you'd make a mistake if you just said, oh, this is some Democrat, I'm not going to work with him. So what I also think he brought that I saw was, I think when he was running and before he got there, there was a very narrow view in the public mind about what the county does. It was essentially, we run the courthouse and we have a stadium. And he had a much bigger vision of how the county could impact people. You know, infant mortality, trying to do something with MSD that no one was paying attention to. And I think whether it was when he was there in the minority or whether Democrats got there, one thing he's done is he was much more creative and visionary. And he's right to do this, that the county touches lives in far more ways than the people who he replaced even appreciated. And I think one reason you had that list built up is he probably knew that when he ran, but he figured it out as the rest of us do when we get there, as he was there. And so all of a sudden, when he had a chance to lead as the president, which he did when I got there, the agenda was very long of all the things that the prior commissioners just hadn't paid attention to.
What do you think some of the biggest legislative items he did were? Which are the ones that made the most difference in the community?
I mean, I think I'll just speak when I got there. I mean, I do think, and it's sadly kind of gone backwards a little bit lately, but when I became a commissioner, it was right after just nonstop fighting. The banks was truly just a parking lot and a mud pit. And I think when we got there and Mayor Mallory was mayor, one of the first, I wouldn't call it legislation, but it just changed the ability of the county and city working together. And I think a lot of good things came from that. And that was, for a few years at least, a real high point of seeing the county and city work together. I was very proud of a lot of things we got done. And by the way, we did in the middle of that recession, so it was a tough time too. But I, you know, the thing that I always admired about Todd was he was so committed very early on to dealing with this issue of infant mortality. Again, back before anyone would have thought that was what a county commissioner was supposed to even be doing. That was sort of way beyond what people thought the footprint of that job was. And so he would take on these very big issues. Obviously, had a major interest in transportation long term, pushed very hard on that. But I would say that trying to find sort of the more human side of the county commission, like things like the infant mortality rate that's just still too high, but he started to make a dent in transportation. And then just trying to get out of this long history of the county and city just not getting along well. I'd say those are some of his biggest accomplishments.
Todd, forgive me, Jay.
I would agree on the banks, and it struck me yesterday when I was thinking about what we were going to talk about that Todd was even involved before there was a banks plan, because he and Jim Tarbell and some others, and I think John Dowlin, who you mentioned, was in on this, that they didn't want the Reds ballpark on the riverfront. They pitched a plan to build it at Broadway Commons, and if you don't know what that is, that was a large parking lot that is now the casino in downtown Cincinnati. And actually, they collected ballot or petition signatures to put that on the ballot in 1998 that gave voters the choice. Do you want the ballpark on the riverfront, or do you want baseball at Broadway Commons? And by, I think it was almost a 2-to-1 margin, voters selected the riverfront plan. Todd got what he wanted. There was a quote that the voters have spoken, and he went with the bank's plan. But as David pointed out, you know, it was Mayor Mallory and Todd that put together the Joint Bank Steering Committee in 2007. They broke ground in 2008 in the middle of a economic recession. And even one of the last things that Todd was able to do on the commission was the city and county were in another fight about the music venue. I think it was at the next to the last meeting that he was able to attend. You know, he called out Mayor Cranley and he said, "You have declared war on the county concerning the music venue at the banks." And the mayor reached out to Todd. They had a meeting at Todd's house and worked out an agreement that solved that problem. The city got what it wanted. The county got what it wanted.
Let me also, real quick though, on these projects, I mean, one thing that Todd brought that was different was the sensitivity that if we're going to do projects like this, it has to bring along the community. So as we did the banks, it wasn't just get the buildings done. It was, are we being inclusive? Are we making sure that we are hiring African-Americans, minorities, to be on these jobs? And we would go over those reports. And we also, once I became commissioner, Todd was the one who pressed for this. Let's make sure we had a member of labor on the banks working group. So this long history of labor feeling shut out from business deals downtown, the minute we got there, that ended. We added Rob Richardson Sr. to the bank steering committee, and all of a sudden you had Bob Castellini and labor leaders working together. So it wasn't just getting it done. It was the philosophy of how to do major projects also changed in a good way.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Michael Monks. Later in the program, we'll remember retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones, who died yesterday. But first, we continue our discussion remembering former Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune. Portune died Saturday at the age of 61. Joining me, Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper, WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. We'd like to hear your thoughts and stories, too. You can call 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. And just before the break, we were hearing from Jay and David talking about the legislation they felt that was instrumental that Todd Portune was a part of. Howard, you didn't get a chance to answer that question.
Well, I agree. I mean, with what Jay and David were saying, and particularly about the banks, that, you know, he understood this idea that everybody had to buy in. It couldn't be just be the business community. It couldn't just be a handful of, you know, people on 4th Street. It had to be everybody. And he did that with one issue after another. Part of that is why I think he was so successful at being like a crossover candidate, that he could draw Republican voters, independent voters, Democratic voters, because people just saw him as a guy who wanted to solve problems. And there are problems, you know, a problem like infant mortality. That's not a Republican problem. That's not a Democratic problem. That's a problem. And everybody can relate to it in one way or another. And he understood that, and he felt passionately about issues like that. That was the main thing about Todd, was this passion, this drive, this unrelenting ability to work an issue until he got, if not everything he wanted, most of what he won.
And just to piggyback on what Howard was talking about, the infant mortality, that led to Cradle Cincinnati. And
oh, yeah.
One thing Cradle needed was money. So he figured out a way to at least do part of that. When UC Health bought Drake Hospital, one of the commitments that UC Health made was a $250,000 a year commitment for 5 years to fund Cradle Cincinnati. And that gave that organization something that it lacked at the time, which was funding.
Speaking of Drake Hospital, it's a place that Todd Fortune spent some time after he was ill, and a lot of changes were coming to Drake, and he was very passionate about that as well. But speaking of his illness, I remember another reporter when I was covering the commission when Todd Fortune came into a meeting where he had been sick, and this is, I believe, when he was having the tumors on his spine and having trouble walking, and they told him he would never walk again, and he came walking into the meeting. I remember the other reporter looked at me and said, "That's a walk-in miracle right there." What do you think gave him the power to fight back through all of the health issues that he was dealing with?
He just had very strong determination, and I'm sure that the first time said, "You're not going to walk again," that was the
that was probably the best thing they could have told him. Right?
Watch me.
Right.
Watch me.
I'll just say, you know, as someone who served with him, these are jobs that take up so much energy and time. You know, meetings downtown, public meetings, parades, you name it. And it's hard enough. And what he had to do physically was so much more than anyone else. And I'll just tell you, I forgot he had any disability. Because he did everything the same as everyone else, even though if you ever took the time and watch him drive to work, get to the commission, it was a much more of a labored effort than anyone else. You never knew it, that you literally would forget, because he just blew through it all. And that I saw him once where I thought, my gosh, he's got to work harder than the rest of us.
Yeah.
And you never really would know it if you watched the way he kept up. It was amazing to watch. One other thing I'd say, Howard mentioned this persistence, this relentlessness on issues. I always, you know, not to over psychoanalyze Todd, but I thought, you know, when you've had your last rites read to you several times and you beat that, no wonder when there was a big vision that others, Todd, that'll never happen. That's not going to happen. That's not, he's thinking, are you kidding me? Look what I've been through. If I've been through what I've been through, don't tell me I can't accomplish this or that. So I think one reason he was so successful on the big picture public stuff was he had come through so much in his own health challenge that the things he was trying to tackle from a public, you know, legislative or good standpoint probably felt like a lot less difficult than the things he'd had to overcome personally.
You couldn't scare him off of any issue,
yeah,
because of what he had faced. I mean, you know, this is a man who just, you know, had to struggle to get dressed every morning,
right,
and be able to get out. And but you, like you said, when he came into a commission meeting, sat down at that table, boom. It was a whole different person. It was all business. He was as focused as you could possibly be. And I used to sit over there sometimes when I'd be filling in for somebody, and I just say, how does he do this? I mean, you know, any other human being would have, you know, just would have gone a long time before. But there was something about him that he just said, I'm not going to let this stop me. And he didn't until it was just overwhelming.
Right.
He, another friend contacted me when they heard we were doing the show and said the one thing that he remembers is when Todd Fortune was on city council and he went to a council meeting and wanted to ask a question about a neighborhood issue. And obviously it wasn't something that was huge that everybody would know about. And he said that it was clear that almost no one on the council had any idea what he was talking about at all, knew nothing about it. He said, except Todd Fortune, who knew everything about it.
That doesn't surprise me. As Howard said, Todd always had very good staff that knew that was one of the things he took seriously. So between himself and his staff, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. And he expected that staff to brief him on those things.
Yep.
So he did a lot of reading, clearly. Time for that to keep up with everything. In just a minute left, any thoughts?
Just a couple of things that I would think that anyone's passing is sad, but for Platoon, I think there was a couple of things that he really would have liked to have seen accomplished. You've got a chance in March for Hamilton County voters to approve a countywide sort of levy, which is something that he was passionate about, was regional transportation. And also the Millennium Hotel. He worked on that. I'm not sure that that – I mean, that was probably going to go where the Port Authority was going to assume the contract to buy that property. But I know that in September things were not looking good, and Todd was – I was told on the phone yelling at people, you need to make this happen. And if all goes as planned, the closing will be on February the 14th. And the important thing is that asset will now be under public control instead of private control.
I'll just say I think even in leaving this successor plan of having Victoria Parks replace him was – I told him – I talked to him about it. I said, what a masterstroke, and you've once again made history with your successor. I love that they've named the building after him. That was so fitting. But let me just say, far bigger than politics, I think his biggest legacy may be for the thousands of other people out there who have health challenges. To see this man never slow down, accomplish so much. You know, I'm blessed right now with good health, thank goodness. But for those out there who get hit with the bad news today, tomorrow, whenever, they have this role model of someone who faces it as bad as anyone could and still accomplished all these incredible things despite it. So I think he really is an inspiration way beyond those who pay attention even to politics.
I have never seen such undaunted courage in a human being in any walk of life. I mean, it was just astounding to watch, and it was amazing. And like David says, it was an inspirational.
Thank you all so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition, and we've been remembering the life of former Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune. He died Saturday after a long battle with cancer. He was 61. In just a moment, we'll look back on the life of retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones, who died yesterday at the age of 93.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WBXU.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. Longtime civil rights leader and retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones died at his home in Cincinnati yesterday. Judge Jones was the NAACP's general counsel and served on the federal appeals court bench in Cincinnati. Joining me to talk about his life are Ohio Democratic Party chairman and former law clerk to Jones, David Pepper, University of Cincinnati College of Law dean and Nippert professor of law, Verna Williams, former Inquirer reporter and Miami University faculty member Mark Kernute, who's joining us on the phone. Mark, making sure you're there?
I am.
All right. Thank you, Mark. And also, Mark has written a remembrance of Judge Jones for the Inquirer, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. We'd like to hear your stories, too. If you'd like to join us, call 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. To start the discussion, I thought I'd also ask just your connection to Judge Jones and... If you can start for us, Verna.
Sure. I joined the University of Cincinnati College of Law's faculty in 2001, and I met Judge Jones shortly after that because he was very involved with the law school, either speaking, teaching as an adjunct professor, and he was involved with the Urban Morgan Institute for Human Rights. So I got a chance to meet him in that capacity. And then, you know, our friendship grew over the years.
David?
So I first met Judge Jones. He was a moot court judge at Yale Law School, and I drove him back, because we were both from Cincinnati. I drove him back from New Haven all the way to LaGuardia.
Oh, wow.
That's a couple hours.
Yeah. Wow.
We had the best time. And I ended up having the honor of clerking for him in 1999. And then we actually went on to co-teach a UC law class of voting rights and election law for a couple years. And we actually also we're at the same law firm. So we've been friends, and he's been a mentor of mine since that clerkship. And my family and his family have also been close for some time.
Mm-hmm. Howard?
Well, Judge Jones was one of the first people I met, particularly in the federal system, when I came to Cincinnati in 82. And we hit it off very, very, you know, right away. I mean, I enjoyed many times just going over into his chambers and sit and talk. He would do that with anybody who was interested in civil rights and civil liberties. And he would sit there and he would talk with you for hours. And we became friends, and we became very friendly. And it's just kind of hard to imagine the scene here in Cincinnati without Nate Jones.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. I would be remiss if I didn't say, you know, the University of Cincinnati is not also – it's a place where he taught, but he's also an adopted alumnus. He went to law school in Youngstown, and that law school doesn't exist anymore. So we basically adopted him as one of our own. And I was really proud to name our Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice after him.
Mark Carnute on the phone. Now, your connection?
When I got to town at the Inquirer in May of 1993, shortly after I was assigned by the late editor Larry Beaupre, a pretty expansive series on race relations. And as part of that extensive reporting, deep reporting, I was introduced to Judge Jones, and like Howard was saying, would often end up in his chambers, you know, talking about civil rights, human rights, civil liberties. And even though my, you know, tenure at the Inquirer wound through sports and back, he and I stayed in touch, and I had the, you know, the honor of writing about him several times. And we became, as Howard said, I think that even from a media standpoint, it was difficult, and it was always, he was so open and warm, and he could spot your interest, your sincere interest. And he saw, as Verna was saying, he was always educating. He was an educator. And so really it was many years ago, and we have stayed close for, my goodness, it was 25, 26 years now.
Let's talk a little bit about his background. As Verna, you mentioned, he grew up in Youngstown, mm-hmm. and went to school there. Can you have that background? Can you share with us what happened?
I don't have it all, you know, at the my fingertips, but I do know that you know, he went to law school, and at a time where there weren't many African Americans going to law school, and he distinguished himself in the legal profession very early. He was the first assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern District of Ohio. He was assistant counsel for the Kerner Commission. And then, of course, he litigated for the NAACP, and he handled cases of school desegregation in the North. I mean, it's pretty well known about the problem of segregation in schools in the South. Judge Jones was handling the even more difficult cases in the North. And then President Carter appointed him to the federal bench, where he served on the Circuit Court, the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, starting in 1972. And he held that position until, I believe, it was 2002. So he had a really wonderful career, and it's one, as you can tell, I mean, the scope was very broad, and it was one that was focused on social justice and civil rights. He said in his book that that was his calling, and he was really dedicated to that, and he really inspired, I think, all of us who are working in the field just by seeing, you know, how he kept at it. I mean, even when I came to him with the idea of naming our Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice after him, I had to go to Blank Rome, because after he finished serving on the bench, he went to Blank Rome, and he worked there, and he went to work every
That's
single
a law
day.
Firm. It's That's a law firm.
Sorry, it's okay. A law firm here in Cincinnati, and you know, met him at the firm because he was still going to work. And so, to my knowledge, I mean, up until the time that he got very sick, he was going into work every single day. So, I mean, he was quite the role model for steadfastness, for dedication, for excellence. His brilliance in legal strategizing is well known. And then just sort of the depth of knowledge. I mean, having confronted different forms of discrimination and using the law as a tool to address them. He had an incredible wealth of perspective and knowledge. And so with my colleagues, Emily Ho and Kristen Kalson, wanted to launch a Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice, he was one of the people we went to in town to talk about it, because, I mean, it was like a no-brainer. Like, I don't even have an answer, because he's Judge Jones. We're going to go talk to Judge Jones about this. He was an incredible resource and just completely woven into the tapestry of social justice work here, as well as nationally and indeed internationally, because he went to South Africa as well after the end of apartheid.
David?
Yeah, I'll just Mark will probably know a lot more about this than anyone, but he was always from Yale. Even though we were very blessed, he moved to Cincinnati. But when I clerked for him, even though he was probably in his, I think, mid-70s, he drove to Youngstown all the time.
He was in the car. A Youngstown guy.
Yeah, he was a Youngstown guy. And so when I'm in Youngstown now, you know, the federal courthouse there has his name on it. And so he was always sort of had – now his family passed away in the last several decades where he didn't visit as much. But Youngstown was also always a part of him. And the two things I remember most about that Youngstown days, and this shaped his own treatment of clerks and the dean and others. Every desk he ever had, he had a photo of one of his mentors from Youngstown who he would – Maynard Dickerson, he'd talk about him all the time, who had taken him and said, you've got talent. I see it, even though not everyone else in Youngstown sees it, and I'm going to help you get there. And he never forgot the people in Youngstown who saw a young kid facing a lot of obstacles and saw the talent and helped them. So that mentorship from people along the way in Youngstown not only changed his life but made him an amazing mentor to so many later. The other thing I'll never forget him telling was a story. He worked, I think, as a busboy in an all-white country club in Youngstown. And I don't know when he brought this up to me. He said, you know, David, I'll never forget. They talked, some of the people around the table, there I am picking up silverware, doing something else. And they would say things that were discriminatory in front of me as if I wasn't even there. And if you know Judge Jones, you know he would have stayed quiet at that moment. Mm-hmm. But I think that kind of, you know, just treatment and observe, he would have observed it. Really helped shape him. And I always thought later what those men at that country club would have thought if this, you know, teenager probably, who they didn't even see, if they knew, you know, 50 years later, he's the one sitting that bench changing the world. But I think that Youngstown really did shape a lot of his whole approach to life later. And we benefited from that when he moved to Cincinnati.
I was going to grab Mark. You've written a lot about his childhood and or his growing up years. Tell us more about what you know.
Well, I think you know, Verna and David have really put it together well. He never forgot where he was from. He never forgot what he experienced, and he always talked about his mentors insisting that he learn how to write well. You know, not allowing him to stray or get caught. You know, and go down the wrong path. You know, and he always said to me, too, that he, you know, once he got his law degree and opened his office, his law office in Youngstown, you know, for a while he was pretty confident that that's where he was going to stay. And then the NAACP came calling, you know, and other opportunities, you know, in the federal government. But he was Youngstown through and through, and his editor, his book editor, Howard Wells, told, you know, had a great anecdote about it. Is they spent 10 years researching the book. He said going back to Youngstown with Judge Jones was like going to the Jersey Shore with Springsteen. So that was definitely Judge.
Howard, you have a story about when he first came to Cincinnati and the type of discrimination that was going on at that time and what he had to do just to get a haircut.
Well, actually, it was a shave.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. He told me that story years ago. Came here in 1963. He was an assistant U.S. attorney. And he stayed at the Sheraton Gibson Hotel downtown. And he was going to appear in court the next day. And he thought – he was in his room. And he said, I really need a shave. I want to present myself. And he always was – perfectly dressed, perfectly groomed. I mean, he was, you know, dressed to the nines all the time. So he said, I need a shave. I got to get one. And so he calls down to the barber shop in the hotel. And they said, well, yeah, come on down. So he comes down to the place, into the barber shop. There were about 10 barbers sitting there. They were all drinking coffee and reading newspapers, he said. And he announced that he wanted a shave. And one by one, they all said, well, we don't do that for black people. So we're just not going to do it. And he was stunned. I mean, he had seen discrimination before, but he didn't really expect it in that kind of context. And, you know, he could not find a barber or anyone else who would give him a shave. So he had to go somewhere down in downtown Cincinnati, buy a razor, buy some shaving cream, and he ended up giving himself a shave in the restroom in the courthouse the next morning. And he says, that always stuck with me, you know, that I had to do that. And little did he know at that time that he would be coming back to Cincinnati as a U.S. District judge.
One of the other interesting things about him, and I've read it in a couple of places, is that, Howard, you've talked about it. Mark, I know you've talked about it, that there's a possibility he could have been on the Supreme Court. And who wants to tell that story? I mean, I think, Mark, do you want to, or Howard?
I was covering it at the time, and Michael Dukakis was the Democratic candidate for president in 1988 against George H.W. Bush. And I had a number of people who were pretty well placed in the Democratic Party who were telling me that if Dukakis managed to win the presidency, that the first vacancy on the Supreme Court would go to Nathaniel R. Jones of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And if that had happened, he would have been there to this day. And Clarence Thomas would not have been there at all, period. Now, you know, you can look at it two different ways. Say, well, that would just mean that Donald Trump would have an appointment to make now that Judge Jones has passed away. Well, it would also mean that for some 30 years, we would have had Nathaniel Jones on the U.S. Supreme Court instead of Clarence Thomas. And I think there's a whole lot of people who would say that would be a pretty good trade.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU, remembering the life of retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones. My guest, you just heard from Howard Wilkinson. He's WVXU's senior political analyst. Also here today is the chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party and former law clerk to Judge Jones, David Pepper. Former Enquirer reporter, Miami University instructor Mark Kernute. He has written a remembrance of Judge Jones, and University of Cincinnati Law Dean and Nippert Professor of Law Verna Williams. Easy for me to say. Mark, I wanted to ask you to perhaps talk a little bit. You were around Judge Jones and with him some as he was writing his memoir, Answering the Call. What was that like? What did he go through as he was writing the book?
You know, he started the research in 2006, and initially he and his editor Howard Wells were planning a three-book volume, and it scaled down to one version of about 420 pages. But in the middle of that writing and editing process and researching, in late 2011, his wife Lillian had died. And shortly thereafter, my former Enquirer colleague and I, Liz Dufour, a visual journalist, and I spent a great deal of time with Judge in his office at Blank Rome talking about his grief and how important his memoir was to Lillian, and how it became part of, I won't say a healing process, that might be overstating it, but really anybody that knew Judge Jones or went to him for advice or a pep talk, you may have expected, you know, soaring oratory, which he was capable of, and precision of language, which spoken or written, it was always him. But he would always say, keep on keeping on. And at least he did to me, and I've heard he said that to quite a few people. And I think Judge took his own advice through his grieving of losing Lillian and kept on keeping on to finish the book. And it became a more urgent process for him once she died. And a quick aside, as Judge was grieving, he and Lillian were going to come to my wedding with Diana. And they did not, they weren't able to come because Lillian died a couple of days before the wedding. And Judge was grieving horribly. And, but I was seeing him, and as many of us were, spending time with him. And he was so gracious and grieving with us and leaning on us the way so many of us had leaned on him. And at one point, I had just done a story with John Doleboy, the former Miami vice president, who was the last living interrogator of the Nazi war criminals. And Diana and I had an idea. These two men had never met, and we had them over for dinner. Judge's daughter, Stephanie, came, and Rabbi Ingber, who at that time was with Xavier University, came as well. And we sat, and we had Aunt Flora's fried chicken and peach cobbler, and it was magnificent for hours. I should have taped it, but for hour after hour, Judge and Ambassador Doleboy sat and told stories back and forth, and these two men had never met, these two men that made history. And it was John Doleboy talking about interrogating Hermann Göring and other Nazi war criminals, and Judge Jones talking about, you know, being mentored by Thurgood Marshall. And it was really this magnificent second half of the 20th century living history, these monumental figures talking about it. But so much of that period for Judge was his grief was poured into his book, but he kept on keeping on.
Verna, did he come to the law school much? Did he work with students much?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he, as David suggested, he was an adjunct professor, so he came in that capacity. He spoke at the law school as recently as, I think, 2017 when the book came out. I remember having the opportunity to introduce him at that time. And we recently launched our Center for Race, Gender, and Social Justice in his name, as I mentioned. And it was a wonderful event. He was there, and he got up, and he spoke to that room of a couple hundred people, and it was really magnificent.
What's the students' reaction to him? Do you think they understand his legacy?
Oh, I think they do. I think that it's a sad time for us at the College of Law. I mean, we lost Todd Portune on Saturday night, and then we lost Judge Jones on Sunday morning. I think, you know, I've posted about it, not that that's the end-all and be-all, and a number, there's so many tributes coming in. The students are aware of these two giants that have great significance for the history of Cincinnati Law School.
If I could add, I got a tweet yesterday from a current city council member in St. Louis who was in our law school class at UC. And she was, you know, she understood it then and tweeted yesterday how sorry she was to see the news. But what interestingly, in my class, and it really goes back to Judge Jones's, some of his philosophy, I would sort of walk through the precedent and the cases, and then he would explain to the kids what was really happening on the ground. And one of the things that he, when I remember, they did a lot of speech writing for him when he was, because he did a lot of public speaking when I clerked for him. And at that moment, he was really concerned about the diversity of the bench. And he was concerned about the diversity of the bench because he said so much of every case is about the facts. But who's interpreting those facts? And there's every case is a battle about that. And his huge concern was that if you don't have a diversity of people on a bench with diverse experiences that inform how you read those facts, you won't have a good justice system. And he preached that as a judge. He preached that as a national leader, saying, if you don't have a diverse bench, you're not interpreting, you don't have a really fair look at facts, you don't have a good system. And even in when we taught our case law, he would be the one that would say, let me break down what was really that. Here's why that literacy test was so horrific. Here's how, why this tactic in suppression really hurt people. Mm-hmm. And so he really insisted on getting into sort of lived experience, and that was a big part of the law as much as sort of the cases in the precedent.
Right.
It was really, and I think students got a lot out of that that often you may not get in law school classes.
Howard, you talked with me this morning about on Morning Edition about how the judge really went after things based on the Constitution and the law. Talk a little bit about how he tried to get things done.
Well, Verna touched on this a little earlier. I mean, he, as general counsel of NAACP, obviously, you know, his focus was on the law, the Constitution. that was the agent of change. That was how you made change happen, was to go through the law and make your case and win. He wasn't the, you know, there are a lot of civil rights activists who take to the streets and, you know, try to pressure government into changing. He was of the mind that the Constitution is already there. Let's use it to our advantage. Let's make it work for us. And that's how he approached his legal work.
Mark, you spent a lot of time with Judge Jones in the last months of his life. Is there anything you'd like to share about that?
You know, I think, you know, everyone is, it's getting, I don't want to be repetitious, but I think the, you know, the dignity of his conduct, both in public, the precision of his language, the high standard he held himself to, as everyone on the panel has had the, you know, the pleasure and the privilege of being close to him, he maintained that dignity even as he knew he was beginning to die. And he, again, was dignified to the end and beloved. And, you know, again, he just... The times he was still in you know, able to communicate well and we would have dinner, you know, he was always reading. He was always aware of what was going on in the news. And even when he was hospitalized this last time in December was the week of the impeachment vote in the House of Representatives. And while he was, you know, there was concerns about his level of consciousness and other things. I mean, this is classic Judge Jones. He had had some vision issues as well. And one of the doctors asked him if he could see the television. And he was reading the Cryon as well. But they asked him if he could see it. And he began to recognize individual members of Congress. And here he was in poor health, but he was talking about this person and that person and where this person stood and where that representative was, and this guy was a jerk, which is about as fierce as he would get verbally on somebody. But it was his knowledge, his perspective, his dignity, his gentleness. It never left him until the very end.
Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you. We could talk for another half hour at least. I bet we could. But thank you so much for being here today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the life of retired federal judge Nathaniel Jones. My guests today were Ohio Democratic Party chairman and former law clerk to Judge Jones, David Pepper, former Inquirer reporter and Miami University instructor Mark Carnute, who has written a remembrance of Judge Jones for the paper, University of Cincinnati Law Dean and Nippert Professor of Law Verna Williams, and WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Producer for today's program is Elise Meckler. Assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Today's technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Michael Monks. Coming up next, we'll bring you NPR's coverage of the impeachment trial of President Trump. That's here on 91.7 WVXU.